if you're sad more days than you're not, if you have a hard time getting out of bed, if you have a hard time getting things done that you used to be able to get done, if you're feeling really anxious, if you're sleeping too much, eating too much, or sleeping too little, eating too little, or really if you're thinking life's not worth living or something along those lines, and that in particular, you need to talk to somebody to help you figure this out.
I'm Doug Bopes, personal trainer, best-selling author, and entrepreneur, and I'm on a mission to help others become the best version of themselves. So I'd like to welcome you to the Adversity Advantage podcast, where we will help you use obstacles, failures, and setbacks to give you that edge needed for success. I'll be interviewing people from all walks of life on how they overcame trials and turned them into triumphs. So please, sit back, relax, and get ready to be absolutely blown away by some of the wisdom and stories you're about to hear. Welcome back to another episode of the Adversity Advantage. I'm your host, Doug Bopst, and today's guest is Nolan Williams, MD. Nolan is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford School of Medicine and is a triple board certified psychiatrist and neurologist. He is also the director of the Stanford Brain Stimulation Lab. Today on the show, we discuss the true root cause of depression, how Nolan's work with TMS is helping people with treatment-resistant depression, why reversing depression involves regaining control, why we need scalable solutions to address the current mental health crisis we face, the fastest way to get out of a depressive episode, whether or not your habits play a role in your mental health, and so much more. So let's get this conversation going and welcome Dr. Nolan Williams to the Adversity Advantage podcast. Nolan, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I think a good place for us to start is based on all of your research, based on what you've learned through your work with neuromodulation and TMS. How do you define something like depression, and what do you believe causes it?
What in other areas of medicine may be a really easy question ends up being hard in psychiatry, right? Because depression isn't diagnosed as it stands right now as like a biological marker. It ends up being a collection of symptoms. So depression is a collection of a specific set of symptoms. Some of them are more unique to depression. Some of them overlap heavily with other conditions, like obsessive compulsive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, or PTSD. There's some of those similar overlap areas. And there's kind of thousands of combinations of the symptoms, right? Depression can be partially described as a problem of people sleeping too much and eating too much. And that's what we call atypical depression, or sleeping too little and eating too little, right? The extremes of each other, which are kind of interesting. Some people have anxiety, some people don't. Some people have what we call anhedonia, or the loss of pleasure. Other people don't. Some people think about ending their life. Other people don't. There's a pervasive sense of sadness. There's a disability in most people, and there's a disability related to that. And for some people, there's cognitive issues. But it's this kind of amalgam of a lot of symptoms. And you just need to have some of a list, which is what makes it really tough, right? And so, what we've been trying to do is to use focal neuromodulation to actually try to get a handle on that list and to kind of refine that bigger list down to a smaller list of symptoms that seem to kind of respond to focal stimulation in a given brain region, and to try to find brain biology that links to that, making it look a lot more like how people think about neurological illness. So that's kind of the current structure of what we've been up to. And what we've found is that in some people with depression, there's a flip of a direction of signaling, where actually the area that turns on during conflicts and in some ways during sadness, the cingulate cortex, is actually signaling up to the control region. And so that's our kind of current kind of hypothesized definition of some people's depression. And what's cool about that is those are the people that respond to stimulation. And those are the people, and when they do respond to stimulation, then the signal flips back to the normal direction. But it's not everybody with depression.
I heard you say in another interview, big thesis of yours is that depression is caused in many ways by lack of control. Is that what you're kind of alluding to with what you just said?
Yeah, the brain region that's involved in control signals first in normal people and in some depressed individuals, but not others. But when the signal is flipped, so that another brain region is in front of it temporally is actually signaling to it, controlling it. In those individuals, they respond really well to focal stimulation to that control region. And it actually, the stimulation reestablishes control dominance of that region, right? It reestablishes that region being the first to signal. And that's what we think is important.
So I'm just thinking about it in like real life terms, because I feel like a lot of times myself or others that I've known that have fallen into these, and I'm talking like just mild forms of depression, is that maybe it's something to do with like a relationship and they're like, all right, I don't know if I'm going to find love. So, and I can't control that. So I like might get depressed about that situation or that outlook, or I don't know if I'm going to make money, or I'm in a bad financial state. I can't control this situation. And so I guess what I'm getting at is, if we understand that that is what causes depression, is feeling out of control in situations similar to what I just described, what's the solution for somebody to be able to like get out of that so that they can take some steps into feeling better?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of mild depression, right, we think about psychotherapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy, for instance, and that works in mild depression, right? People with mild depression respond really well to psychotherapy because that control region isn't out of whack. It's not, you know, out of our control, right? Like the control region is signaling appropriately. It's just a content problem, right? And so in that region of your life, you know, you don't feel like you're in control, right? And another way of thinking about it is, you know, if you were in a situation where you got in a car accident and somebody in the other car was in trouble and needed your help, you could probably easily in those situations get out and help that other person, right? You still have control and volition in other areas, and you have more of a kind of a limited sense of loss of control, right? In that example that you gave. For people with severe depression, they have no control over really much of any of their life, right? They're completely incapacitated. So it's a much broader problem, that not just one kind of area. It's like they are pretty much out of control as a generality. And we see that in the brain image, right? Their brain just doesn't have any capacity for control. And what they'll say in the severe depression is, I can't do psychotherapy. I just can't do it. My brain can't do it, right? And that's because it's no longer just a content problem. It's that the brain can't kind of functionally do it.
Yeah, because I think it's so different. Like somebody who's just in a depressive state, you know, for a period of time about a situation in their life, versus somebody who's got severe depression and then their entire just outlook on the world is just suppressed, right? And just very limited. And yeah, it makes sense, because I think when somebody goes to like something like psychotherapy, at least even in my own experience, it's like, all right, I can talk about my feelings, I can talk about my emotions, but how do I get out of this hole? Like, how do I make my life better? Like, talking about my feelings, maybe it helps a little bit, but like, how do I actually improve my overall outlook on life? And with all that said, how has TMS and neuromodulation and the work that you're doing, how has it helped people like improve their outlook on life when they're in something like severe depression?
What we see in people that do well with this is that they end up coming out of it and feeling like they have this kind of global sense of control. They come out of it and they feel like, you know, many of them, I tell them to rest on the weekend. They do this very intensive stimulation approach. I tell them to rest on the weekend. Instead of resting, they come back on Monday and say, I read some of these psychotherapy homework books. Now I finally understand it. Now I can do it. Their brain is kind of in a place to be able to do it. You know, psychiatric illness is on the spectrum of volition, right? And you're kind of tapping into that. Other things are on a spectrum of volition, right? Even some neurological illness, Tourette syndrome, for instance. You know, in the very mild side of things, you pretty much have volition. At the extreme end, like with catatonia, you have no volition. People that are catatonic are frozen, they're stuck, they can't move, they have no volition, right? And everybody falls on that spectrum. And so what you're saying is, at some point you've had an experience where you've had less volition about how you're thinking about problems. I wouldn't call that mild depression, right? If you feel like you're going into psychotherapy and that's not working and meds aren't working, all of a sudden you fall into a more severe category, right? On the scheme of the RAM. And I'm not trying to diagnose you right now, but just to give you kind of a sense of things. And so when people hit into this area where the standard stuff stops working, then you start entering into the realm where other things like neurostimulation or other really aggressive medication treatments, like some of the rapid acting treatments like ketamine and psychedelics that are being explored now and other things kind of come into play, right? But that's in an area where people can't do the standard stuff. They can't do psychotherapy. They feel out of control. That's typically when I see people, right? I don't see the people that go to psychotherapy. I don't do psychotherapy with people, you know, mild, you know, new onset cases or treatment naive people. We see people when they failed everything, right? And those are the people that have, you know, this kind of diminished or loss of sense of volition. That's where we kind of pick up and start really treating them. And what we're trying to do is restore the brain so that they can actually go in and do psychotherapy. That's what's really interesting about this, is that we've had a lot of people who are able to kind of finally comprehend it after that.
So walk me through the process of what that looks like for the sake of the conversation. Say I'm a patient. Let's just say I've tried everything. I've tried psychotherapy. I've tried a medication. I've tried exercise. I've tried all these things and nothing seems to help my emotional and mental state. I come to you. I say, I want to try TMS, neuromodulation. What does the setup look like? I mean, how do you, what's the protocol like? And then like, what are you like looking for as far as like, what parts of the brain are you trying to change? What neurotransmitters are you trying to upregulate, downregulate, et cetera?
So TMS has been around for a long time. It's like a general catch-all term, and it really is referring to the equipment. The treatment itself is the protocol, and there are a bunch of different protocols. We've been working on a really kind of personalized medicine rapid version of this that got FDA clearance in 2022. So I'll start with the older protocol just to give you a sense of things, and then we can get into the newer things. So the older one, you know, about an hour a day, 5 days a week for 6 weeks, and about a third of people in open label studies will have an elimination of depression at the end of that. It doesn't involve a brain scan, involves using average coordinates, average positions in the brain across, you know, the general population. And remarkably, from my perspective, about a third of people in the general population receive benefit. When you get into the more treatment-resistant, severe population that we've studied, is about 17%. What we've done is we've figured out a way to compress the entire six-week course into a day, and then we get 5 days worth. So we give about the equivalent of about 7.5 months. And we do that with neuroimaging guidance. So we're specifically trying to get into a part of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex that regulates mood and connects to that cingulate cortex I was talking about earlier. And so every person gets personalized mapping, gets their brain mapped, and then the target generated, and then the coil over that area, and then a kind of neurobiologically relevant stimulation approach applied within that area. And what we find is that closer to 80 to 90% of people get better with that, both in blinded trials and open label studies. And we think that that's because we're getting into the right spot, sending an adequate amount of signal for an adequate dose. That's the principles that, you know, we've modified in our stimulation approach. But either way, you're generally getting stimulated in that control region. And so whether you get an MRI or not is different between the protocols, between the treatments, if you will. But some form of targeting happens. You have a coil placed initially on your motor cortex to get the intensity of the stimulation based on your own brain. That's true for all TMS, our TMS kind of treatments. And then, you know, the coil's placed on the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and then you're applied whatever treatment protocol you've signed up for. And at some point along the process, if you're getting better and you have been thinking about wanting to end your life, that starts to go away. Your ability to do things starts to come back, the fluidity of movement, the kind of natural smile, the kind of external facing aspects of depression that your family may notice even more than you or your friends or whatever, that tell them that you're doing better. And then the last thing that gets better, and this seems to be a principle of depression and not of anything specific to TMS or our protocols or whatever, is that the person will say they're feeling better. And that's the last thing that happened. They'll say their mood is better. So before that, all these other metrics get better. And then at the end, the mood gets better. And what we find is that people that have been really thinking over and over again about wanting to end their life, all of a sudden, early in the treatment, say they haven't thought about that since they started, that sort of thing, which is pretty cool. And so that's the idea. You know, this will be in April 2024, this will be available by Medicare, you know, the rapid version to go into psychiatric hospitals so that people that are in emergencies can get it. And that'll be paid for by Medicare, and then others are kind of following along. But I think what's cool about that is that it gives people the ability, you know, to deal, you know, for all TMS forms, to deal with their depression outpatient, and for folks in emergencies to be able to go into the psych hospital and get this rapid form.
That's super fascinating. So from the perspective of like just really like rapidly being able to like essentially reverse depression, is the main mechanism for doing so that you're, you know, really working on that control region of the brain and then helping them regain control? Like, what is that like doing for their,
do you work out?
Yeah. Like,
yeah. Yeah. So, you know, like, you know, people can bulk up really fast if they just spend all their time doing it, right? Like you do some exercise in the morning, you go get some food, you do it again in the middle of the day, you go get some food, you do it at night. It's exhausting, but you can really generate a lot of muscle mass quicker if you do it in a stacked way, right? Where you're doing multiple workouts in a day, right? Versus trying to do, you know, a half hour of it, you know, kind of longer term. It's going to take you longer to get to the same point. The brain does the same thing, actually. It's what we call space learning theory. It's the reason why you could cram for studies in college and get away with studying for a week, right? It's because the brain can learn if it's exposed to something and then given time to process it and exposed to it again. That's the idea. And so it's really about sending a signal for that brain region to turn on, but not just turn on, but to remember to turn on and stay on, right? Because it's not just about you sitting in the chair and feeling in control. That's not that useful. What you need to do is walk out of the TMS session and go, and you run into that ex-girlfriend that tripped off your depression, or the ex-boyfriend or whatever that tripped off your depression. You see this person and all of a sudden you feel like in control. And so a lot of times people will tell me these really interesting anecdotes where they're like, you know, I got into this situation and I thought that I was going to lose it and I didn't. It's the first time I've not done that before. I felt actually in control for the first time in these situations. And so, which is pretty cool. And, you know, we had a patient, and this was kind of unfortunate. I had a patient whose significant other actually told them halfway through, once they remitted, that they wanted to divorce, which was like totally a bummer for us, right? Because like, you know, and for the patient, because it was like, wait, you know, you're gonna, you know, say this and then leave this poor lady and then like kind of leave her with us to take care of it. Now we took care of it. The significant other went back to LA, and it was kind of a wild situation. But this person like went from really, really low on the depression scores. It was like super good mood wise to a bump. We kept treating this individual and we were able to get them through it. And we called them and they said, you know, I'm handling this so well. Like, I'm handling this news of a divorce. I can't believe it, but I'm actually able to handle it, right? Which is pretty wild. But if you think about it as a way to kind of control situations that are normally out of our control, you know, this individual was able to do that, right? And so, you know, that's what we think we're doing. We're really buffing up the brain region that's involved in clamping down on sadness, clamping down on these feelings of out of controlness, and saying, I'm in control. And it's all, and for some people, it's like better than their normal functioning at times, right? They feel like super in control, which is pretty interesting.
So staying with the example of bulking up and working out, like I know that if you bulk up, like there needs to be some maintenance in order to maintain that muscle and continue growing that muscle if that's your goal. What's the plan look like for some of the patients that come into the lab to do this? They quote unquote bulk up their brain. They, you know, they jack up their control region, like what are they doing in daily life to maintain that?
Well, the cool thing is that that control region that you're buffing up then gets worked out in the world, right? That's the difference between extra, I mean, whatever, like you bulk up a lot and then you go and your job is to whatever it is, like you bulk up in the gym and then your job is to like be a mover and you lift furniture all day. Well, you may not need to go work out as much, right? Because you are already bulked up and then you're carrying refrigerators all day or whatever it is, right? For some of us, I feel like I'm one of these people, you know, you're carrying mental refrigerators all day, right? Like you're dealing with these really high control sort of situations where you have to be able to deal, right? You may feel like that, right? Like you're having to deal with all of, you know, you're having to come into this, you know, this interview and prep and know a lot of things, right? There's a lot of control aspects to that. And so for some people, they get well and they hold it for a long time. You know, we have people that haven't relapsed yet. There are other people where probably because more, it's more of a biological thing that they're, or kind of their brain's been so exposed to being out of control for so long. Maybe they had early child life trauma or whatever it is when they were a kid. And their brain is set up to be kind of back into this state of not feeling in control. And those people, they end up being in a situation where you need to kind of work it back out, right? And if you do kind of regular touch-ups, then you can keep them in control, right? So I think it's very, that part's very individualized, very different person to person. We haven't found a way to figure out how to optimize for each person, but it's interesting. It, you know, it's a dose thing. If you just give people enough, you can keep them, you know, you can keep them well indefinitely, it appears.
Like a lot of people, I think they misunderstand, like if they're actually depressed, like we talked at the beginning and that depression can be confusing and that sometimes depression can carry similar symptoms as OCD and anxiety. How can somebody tell, like based on what you've learned through all the work that you're doing with TMS and neuromodulation, like how can somebody actually tell if they're truly like depressed and not just like in a funk or in a rut?
Everyone's kind of bad at it, but guys are really bad at it, you know? And so, you know, it's one of these things that if you're asking yourself that question, it's more likely that you are than you're not, unless you have other kind of hypochondriacal sorts of traits where you're worried you have everything. You know, there is a subpopulation of people that worry they have everything, maybe not for those people, but for the general population, particularly, you know, men are less good at going to the doctor when things are not in good shape. They'll avoid it. And so it's one of these things where if you're thinking it, you probably need to talk to somebody, either your general practitioner or mental health, you know, professional to get evaluated. If you're sad more days than you're not, if you have a hard time getting out of bed, if you have a hard time getting things done that you used to be able to get done, if you're feeling really anxious, if you're sleeping too much, eating too much, or sleeping too little, eating too little, or really if you're thinking life's not worth living or something along those lines, and that in particular, you need to talk to somebody to help you figure this out. I saw a paper that came out like last week that said that 50% of people will have a mental health diagnosis before 75, or meet criteria for mental health diagnosis before 75, 50% of people. So if you're thinking it, you probably, you know, more likely than not, there's something there, because the odds are that you're going to get it. In a married couple or in a, you know, two partners, one of them is going to have a mental health struggle. It's statistically probably, right? I mean, that's huge, right? To, you know, as a, not just depression, but as a general statement. I think if you think you have something, then you know, the next step is to see a mental health professional or your PCP or whatever to figure out what that something is. And it may not be depression, maybe PTSD, maybe generalized anxiety disorder, you know, something like that. But going in and getting evaluated for one of those things is important. And then depression is going to be high up the list of probable, given it's, you know, pretty high incidence, sort of high prevalence sort of problem. I think there are a lot of people that struggle for a long time with these problems, and it really cuts down quality of life. It cuts down productivity. And what happens is they wait till last minute when things are really, really bad and they're about to lose their job, and then they want to fix it really, really quickly. That's always a bad position. It's a bad position for the person to be in. It's a bad position to put the doctor in, to be quite frank, because up until some of our, you know, methodologies, there hasn't really been rapid ways of getting people out of it. So even if the doctor could see you tomorrow, you know, with a lot of the treatments, it's going to take months and months to get you better. And if you're about to lose your job, it's a hard position for everybody to be in. And so it's much better for people to, you know, if you think you could be, it may be better for you to just visit your primary care doctor and get a sense of it.
I know you talked about that, like, people don't typically come to you with, you know, quote unquote, like mild depression, right? You're seeing the people that they're coming to you with like severe issues. But given your background as a, you know, as in a clinical setting, as a clinician, like, I would imagine that you've dealt with a fair amount of people over your, the course of your career who have had mild depression. And I think a lot of people who have listened to this have been in that, or maybe will be in those phases where they're just feeling slightly depressed, but they want to make sure that they're not falling further down the spectrum into severe depression. Like, what have you found that really is effective for the general population?
If you're like me and are constantly on the go juggling work, social outings, and all the other chaos life throws your way, I have found an absolute game changer that gives me some time back. Jimmy's Famous Meals is a local meal prep company that provides fully cooked, chef-prepared meals and can deliver them right to your doorstep. I am currently about to eat the Greek lemon chicken, which is one of my favorites. I get this every week, and I absolutely love Jimmy's Famous Meals. They are so good and delicious. Picture this: no more stressing over what to cook after a long day, and always having a wholesome, delicious meal waiting for you in your fridge. Their meals are prepped, cooked, and ready to heat and eat in minutes. So say goodbye to the hassle of grocery shopping and meal planning. With Jimmy's Famous Meals, convenience is served straight to your doorstep. So if you're looking to get your time back and make healthy eating easy, head to jimmysfamousmeals.com. And when you use the promo code Doug25 at checkout, you'll get 25% off your order. Cheers to healthy eating.
As a general statement, there aren't enough therapists in the world, which is a problem. Right. And there aren't enough people going to those, not enough therapists in the world, which is the other problem. But, you know, if we fix the first problem of there aren't enough therapists in the world, you know, I think most people would benefit from having a therapist of some sort. And people are trying to solve this out in various ways, chatbots and all this stuff. So it doesn't have to be a human or whatever. And we'll see how all that goes. But in is like theoretically, right, if there were enough therapists in the world, then I think everybody should have a therapist, right? Because then you'd have somebody there to really be able to check in, maybe not even very frequently, but he'd be able to check in and say, you know what, I'm headed down this direction. I really don't want to go there, right? And how bad off am I really? Or are you worried about me? That sort of thing, right? The primary care doctors sometimes can function in those roles. And actually, primary care doctors, you know, prescribe about, I think the statistic is like 70 or 80% of the antidepressants in the United States, just to give you a sense of things. And so, you know, most people have a primary care doctor, and that's somebody that everybody could check in with. You don't need a therapist to be able to have your primary care doctor check in. They're actually quite good because they have to be at evaluating these things. Now, there's a variability in the background knowledge and all that. Some know more than others. As a generality, that's a good first step for people if they feel like they're going the wrong direction, is to go see their primary care doctor and ask them, do I need to see a mental health professional specifically on this one, you know, and get feedback on that.
Continuing this thread, I know you talk a lot about psychiatry 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. And, you know, we've been in this space for a while now where there's been an increasing amount of, I mean, while you said that not a lot of people are going to these therapists that we don't have, and there's more therapists that are needed, there's still been so much more, at least from what I've seen, information, access, and stuff like that over the last, let's say, 10 years specifically than ever before, between content online, podcasts, stuff like that. Why are we in the position that we're in, and how do you see like something like you've coined the term psychiatry 3.0? Like, how do you see something like that, like really being able to be the catalyst for changing this mental health crisis we're in right now?
It's about scaling, right? And it gets into that comment I said a second ago about there aren't enough therapists. There aren't enough, you know, psychopharmacologists either, right? And that's why the primary care doctors do a lot of it, is because there are enough psychiatrists that do prescribing, right? It's a scale problem, right? Where you need to be able to scale a certain number of people. So the old kind of Freudian psychotherapy idea is you see the person once a day, every day, 5 days a week, you know, and in that model, you can see 8 total patients, right? In more modern psychotherapy practices, you see somebody once a week, so you can see 40 people or something like that. For med management visits, you only need to see somebody once a month for 30 minutes, so you can see like 350 people or something like that. Even with those numbers, you can't get to the number you need to be able to treat. Circuit-based therapeutics don't require the doctor to be as involved. There's a prescription for the treatment and the doctor's involved at the very beginning of the kind of therapeutic application. But after that point, you know, you can have medical assistants do a lot of it, right? And so then it can be, you know, automated, so you can scale out to thousands of patients. And the beauty of that is you could actually make a dent in the problem, right? If we do that sort of thing, we make a massive dent in the bigger problem. And we can't really do it. We either have to train more people, or we have to develop treatments that don't require as much direct psychiatry or mental health involvement. I'm totally like agnostic to this. Specific phobia. Psychotherapy is very good for specific phobia, right? If you have a plane phobia, like flying on a plane or driving in a Fiat or whatever it is, or spiders or whatever, you can be really well treated with psychotherapy. And we should scale as many psychotherapists as we need to treat specific phobia, for instance, and I'm just making this up. You know, the problem ends up being if half of us are going to have a mental health diagnosis before 75, and half of us aren't therapists, you know what I mean? It like doesn't, like it's a comp, or a third of us, or a fourth of us, or an eighth of us, or whatever it is. It's hard, right? It's hard. The numbers don't work. And so you have to come up with solutions that are more scalable. So then I've been focused on scalable solutions where you only need one doctor for like a ton of people. And that's another way of dealing with the problem. I don't care what that, I think the problem needs to be dealt with. I don't care what the solution is. I'm a realist, right? I see how the world works. And well, you can get people interested in this. This generation is particularly interested in mental health, and I think there will be more therapists. There probably still won't be enough therapists to handle all the problems. And some people don't respond to therapy, which is the other part of it.
Yeah, I'm interested to know, like, you know, for me, and this is like totally anecdotal, but over the years, I've struggled at times with severe depression, severe anxiety, mild anxiety, panic disorder, mild depression, like OCD and stuff. And what I found is, like, personally, like, therapy helped if I was going through like a breakup to process like my feelings around that, right? Or it helped to process parts of like my parents getting divorced or being picked on in school. But it didn't help me like get what I wanted in life. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't help me actually create a better reality for myself. So I guess is your thesis with like TMS and neuromodulation is that that's like the cheat code for like hacking the brain to like get it to a place where you see more control in your ability for your life to get better. Is that what's happening versus psychotherapy and CBT and stuff like that?
I mean, I think the problem with psychotherapy as a generality is, and it's not like psychotherapy's fault, it's like the nature of how all this goes down, right? So we are the result of like all sorts of stuff. Like our genetics, our the epigenetics, our social environment, our childhood. So the idea that something can like go in and change all that like really quickly, you know, in totality, it just isn't, you know, it isn't realistic. And that's not really realistic kind of across the board for any treatment. I think that psychotherapy, particularly, it's hard because you're pulling a string on one thing for an hour and it's a lot of things, right? What the cheat code, as you call it, what the stimulation does is that it kind of like bypasses that and it's kind of like exogenous. Like one way I talk about it with the psychotherapy trainees is it's like exogenous therapy, and the therapists like, don't like this idea. They're like, wait, they're like you. But I, you know, what happens is you see people like processing information in like a really therapy style, like somebody that's gone through a lot of therapy. People will process information like they just went through a bunch of therapy, right? Successfully. And the reason why is that they're in control. They feel more in control. So they answer stuff like they're a controlled person. They feel in control. So they make decisions like somebody that's in control, and they evaluate situations like there's somebody in control. And so there's an iterative bit to it, right? Where like you then can take a brain like that, and they can go in and do more therapy, and then it's going to work better, probably. I mean, that's our sense of it. It's kind of anecdotally, because they're coming into it from a different place. Psychedelics seem to do a similar sort of thing and have a content component to it, too. It's basically the same sort of general idea, is that you kind of have to match the acuity of the problem with the acuity of the treatment. A little bit of TMS here and there, a little bit of psychotherapy, you're going to get a little bit of a change. You go full tilt on it, you're going to get full change. But it's like a big time investment. In the case of the stimulation work that we're doing, it's a 10-hour blocks for a week, you know, every day, where they're in the chair for about 90 minutes, but they're there all day. They're there for 10 hours a day for 5 days. You know, nobody drops out because those people are so severely depressed that they'll do anything. Right, they'll go in, they'll sit there, they'll do the whole thing. Of course, right? This is terrible for them. It's very painful, so then they're willing to do it. Same thing with the psychedelic thing. It's a couple of days, right, where people have to be off of work or whatever. And so with that comes bigger change.
This might be a bad example, but maybe the listeners or whoever's watching this will understand. It's kind of like doing like a 21-day challenge for a workout, right? And that's like your jump start is you're like, all right, I'm going to like eliminate processed foods. I'm going to work out hard. I'm going to drink water. I'm going to sleep, and I'm going to get jump started. And that's going to hopefully motivate me to enter something more manageable. And it seems like that's kind of what you're describing, is that they come to you to jump start. Am I understanding this correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's right. I mean, if you think about it, like, 500 years ago, people didn't work out, right? Workout is like a modern thing, you know, like they like ran from the lion or whatever, right? Like they ran from whoever was chasing them, did physical activity as a result of their circumstance. You know, some people didn't do physical activity like the kings or whatever. And you know, actually some of the, you know, royalty suffered some of the worst health consequences because of various factors, inbreeding, all that stuff too. But you know, it's like one of these things where modern exercise and the way we think about it, right, where we go to the gym and we lift weights, is something that actually hasn't happened for very long in human history. It's like a relatively new thing. I'm on this kick, and I'm going to do a TEDx talk the next weekend on this. Actually, this idea that people like, they really like interpret reality from their lifetime. If you're not like a super serious student of history, if there's always been a gym since you've been born, then that's just how it is. So working your body out is like totally normal. Like, but it's actually very weird in the scheme of like human history and life, like in the sense that most of human history, we didn't do that. We only do that in modern times. And so if you kind of zoom out and you say, okay, well, doing reps on a dumbbell or whatever it is, barbell or whatever it is for the purposes of getting my muscles bigger makes sense, and it's linked with all these great health benefits, then why wouldn't doing a similar sort of thing with your brain make sense? It may feel weird to people hearing that, because they're like, wait, this is the first time I'm hearing this. This isn't in the context of my entire life, right? Yeah, I'm 41. For me, I've heard about this a lot, obviously, for 20 years, but yeah, friends of mine that aren't in the medical field, this is not something that they've ever heard about. So it seems very weird, right? I bet working out at a gym felt very weird when the first Gold's Gym or whatever it is opened up too, right? This idea that you'd be going in and exercising for certain reasons. I think that's what you're going to see, right? Is that there's going to be more and more of a push towards this idea of kind of stimulating the brain as a way of initially treating a lot of these psychiatric illnesses, but as a way of really thinking about how to keep the brain fit, if you will. And it makes a ton of sense, right? There's data now that TMS can help with early Alzheimer's disease. If your cognition could be better, I mean, think about it. You know, would you do it if you knew you were going to get Alzheimer's? If you didn't do it, would you do it?
Of course. I'd be flying to Stanford tomorrow.
That's right. Right. And so this idea that we have to kind of find ways, probably through neurostimulation, but it could be through cognitive training, to turn these brain regions on and work them out makes a lot of sense, similar to the way that we think about working our muscles out. And it's probably not as weird in the scheme of things as we think about it now, and probably a lot more similar to the way we think about going to the gym.
I guess the same breath as control and, you know, talking about that essentially depression in a lot of cases for people is this lack of control. And then when you're doing TMS and neuromodulation, you're really focusing on the control region of the brain. You'll hear a lot of people say, well, that's their choice. Like, they're choosing to be depressed. They're choosing to make those choices in their life. What is your view on all that? Is depression controllable by lifestyle and the choices we make, or do you believe that it's just a biological condition in the brain that—
Oh, it's totally not control. I mean, there's moments, right? Do you surf?
No, but I heard you talk about that you do surf. I'd be eaten by a shark pretty quickly, I think, if I tried to surf, because I'd fall. But I did do a workout with Laird Hamilton, actually, a couple of years ago, which was super intense.
Yeah, there's this moment in surfing where you're about to drop into the wave where you have a choice. And you're looking down and you're like, you know, I'm about to drop into this wave, or I'm about to drop in and bust, right? Which is a lot of times what it is. You look down and you're like, oh, that's not going to work out. And you kind of pull back and you don't do it, right? And I think there's moments where people, they're like, if I go down this road, then I'm kind of, whether they know that they're at a risk for depression or not, certainly people that have been depressed before have a better sense of this. But if I go down this road, I'm going to risk certain things. I'm going to risk a risk of going down a road that's going to be pretty depressogenic. Once you've committed to go down a certain road, you know, you probably don't have much control, just like you don't have much control of what happens after the board starts going down that face of that wave as far as what happens next. And so that's not everybody. Some people with depression, there's no external environmental trigger. They just pop into it and there's nothing to do with it. Their life is fine. Right? Or it's just general stress. So for almost everyone, they have literally no control. This is going to happen. There are a select few people where they kind of know what the trigger is, and they know if they go down the road, then their risk is higher. So I don't want to say that no one has any control, but it's like most people don't. There are a few people that do have signals, and they have a moment where they could say, you know what, I'm not going to take that ninth project on, or I know that my kid's going to be born soon and there's going to be a lot of stress from that. If I go and take this new harder position at work, then it's going to be a depression risk. Or I know if I get into this disagreement with this person, it's not going to yield the outcome that I want, and it's going to make me feel very sad, and then it's going to trip me off down to depression. There are those moments. A lot, but you know how that goes. Like, a lot of people, like, you don't have that kind of choice. You don't have the luxury of that choice. And so I'd say, you know, as a general, I'm kind of prefacing this because I don't like the idea of people, I don't want to say that people have no control, right? There are situations where they do, but the vast majority of times it's a biological process. As soon as my surfboard starts pointing down the face of that wave, there's nothing I can do about it, right? Like, I'm going down. I'm either going to get up on my feet or I'm going to be on the bottom of the ocean getting flipped around, right? Like, your brain has committed down a path, if you will, right? And that's kind of the more often than not situation. And what happens, to your question, is that a lot of family members will say, just snap out of it, or I feel like that, or whatever, you know. But the problem with that sort of thinking is that they can't. And it's more of a cultural solution that is generational than an individual discussion with a person. Because I'll tell you, I somebody who has a great expertise in this, have personal relationships with people where I'm getting into these discussions with somebody who is a lay person, who's maybe a family member or a related family member, whatever. And I can't get through to them, right? And I'm very good at this, right? Some people are just very fixated on this idea that somebody could snap out of it, or that they're in control of, or whatever. It's very hard, you know? And if I can't consistently, successfully do it and get people on the right side of it, nobody can. I mean, very, you know, I don't want to say nobody can, but it's a very hard place for anybody to get somebody on the other side of it. And so we have to, as a culture, get to a better place. It used, you know, epilepsy used to be highly stigmatized back in the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. There's an international league of epilepsy and all these things that kind of went out and did a bunch of anti-stigma campaigns. Now, when people have a seizure, nobody really thinks like, oh, they, they're in control of that or whatever. They, you know, the kind of basically everybody, the lay population, understands that if somebody has a seizure, it's not their fault. They didn't choose to. They couldn't stop it in most circumstances, blah, blah, blah. If they know if they have seizures from a strobe light, they know to not go into the discotheque. But I mean, as a generality, they can't stop it, right? And so, you know, it's very much like that, but the culture needs to come up with that conclusion. We have to be enculturated in that view, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. And I don't think it's as simple as snapping out of it either. I guess what I will say is, and this is totally anecdotal and just based on my experience and also people that I've known, I've noticed that if I make crappier like life choices, like if I don't work out, if I don't socialize, if I don't sleep well, if I don't eat right, if I don't like, not, if I'm not committed to work, that I definitely will start to feel like worse about myself and worse about my overall outlook on life. Do you think habits like play a role though in all this?
Absolutely. And it's the same thing. The example I said earlier, like, you know, there are patients who will have a seizure from going into strobe lights. Actually, like what the epileptologists do when they want to have these patients have seizures for the purposes of diagnosis with an EEG on, is they'll expose them to strobe lights. They'll actually bring the patient in and strobe them. Now, they're not trying to do that to be mean to the patient or whatever. They're trying to do it to figure out what kind of seizures they have, right? So they'll show, they actually show every patient strobe lights. So if you're a patient and you know that strobe lights cause seizures, you don't go into the disco because you're going to have a seizure, right? It's the same thing as what you're saying, right? It's the same exact idea. You avoid certain things and you do certain things and you have reduced your risk of, but the reality is that there are patients that do that and successfully stave off depressive episodes until grandma dies or until your dad dies, or until your kid dies, or until your house, until you live in Lahaina, right? Or whatever it is. There are just life events that happen that you can't control that'll trip you into depression and you couldn't avoid it. There's probably people in Maui that had depression history and then this thing happened, right? And their house got burned down and they're depressed again. Right. And it's not because of anything other than life happens. Right. And so it's tough. And that's true for people with epilepsy too. Right. They'll avoid all this stuff and then something happens and they'll have a seizure, a breakthrough seizure, and they tried their hardest to avoid it. So absolutely, we can both be in control of those situations and do a lot to do the right things and to avoid the wrong things. And we can still have it happen and it be completely out of our control. All of those things can be true. And we see all of those things happen. And that doesn't say anything about you as a person, right? Or anybody as a person. It has a lot more to do with the fact that brain diseases, and really lots of diseases like cardiac arrhythmias, these things happen, these paroxysmal, and what we call like paroxysmal, like intermittent random events that happen to us as a trigger, sometimes as a trigger of the external environment, are not controllable. Right? And part of there's this like acceptance and commitment therapy thing, the like a kind of therapy that some folks do. And part of having a major mental illness is accepting that, right? Accepting, but that you can be doing the best you can do and still have these things happen. It has nothing to do with you. And I think that's the part that we as a culture, I mean, and I see that as the problem, right? Is that we as a culture don't hold that kind of belief set. It's because it's a complicated belief set to hold. The easier belief sets to hold are, this is totally in your plate and you can get out of it. Or what's equally problematic is, this is totally not controllable by you. And I need to, you know, the world needs to help you. Both of those are problematic because they don't deal with the nuance of what it is. And I've seen both of those happen, right? One holding this idea that you can just get out of it, and then others, and I've seen this in a family, right? Holding this idea that you can't do anything to get out of it. And the problem with both of those is they're kind of in many ways equally disempowering. And really what the solution to that kind of equation, if you will, is something very different. It's you at times will be able to deal with it, and you at times won't. And when you can, you should. And it's not my role to help you as a family member or whatever, or as a, you know, as a non-therapist or non-professional in the equation. I'm talking about kind of at a personal level, you know, for family members or friends. It's not my role to help you when you can help yourself, but it's absolutely my role to help you when you can't. That's why like having a psychotherapist in the groove is helpful, because it's a very hard thing to hold, because you got to let the person have autonomy and ownership when they can, and not have autonomy and ownership in times where they can't. And you have to be able to judge that. That's a really hard thing for a family member to hold. I mean, it's really hard actually for even psychiatry trainees to hold, or for early mental health professionals that are learning to hold, is that that's the game that you have to figure out how to play with people. And that's what's maximally empowering, because it gives you the ability to do it. And so in this gym analogy, right? I couldn't walk in and bench press 500 pounds right now, but I could walk in and bench press 100 pounds. What I should be doing is bench pressing the 100 pounds, not the 500 and not none. That's the game. The game is, because at some point, if I get good at the 100, then I can go to 200 and 300 and get myself out of it. That's the hard part, I think. That's the hard part for people to understand, too, is that it's all of that, right? It's being able to hold that whole thing, and be able to hold the idea that people can do some, and that they can hold some without having to do everything and hold everything.
That's why the whole couch to 5K thing just doesn't work, right? You're not going to get somebody who's been sitting on the couch not exercising for 20 years and they're going to automatically run a 5K, you know, later that week or the next day or whatever. And you see that what you were talking about before in these two extremes in addiction, right? Where parents will either have a tough love approach, or they'll just be fully enabling their kids, right? And it's like neither one work. You have to find something in the middle. I'm interested, God forbid, like you get let go at Stanford tomorrow, massive layoffs happen, and other than trying to focus on getting a new job, what are some things you would personally do other than TMS to maintain some sense of control in your life, in your brain, so that you wouldn't fall into like a deep depression?
Well, the meta, right? And the thing I think that some forms of psychotherapy teach you and some philosophical ideas will teach you is it's not about what happens to you in life. It's how you perceive of it. So it actually would have a lot more to do with why I would be, I mean, thank God I've got tenure, so this can't happen, but why I would be let go, you know, versus more that it happened, right? If Stanford went bankrupt or something, I mean, also never going to happen. They are in extremely good financial positions. So that's the disclaimer. This is highly theoretical, but let's say Stanford went bankrupt in some alternate universe and they had to let everybody go. Well, you'd interpret that very differently than if they let me go specifically because of something that I was unjustly accused of or whatever, right? Like those would be two very different situations with two very different control structures. In the first one of they let everybody go because they couldn't pay for people or whatever, they decide they don't want a hospital anymore or whatever it is, then, you know, you there are a lot of things you can tell yourself about that situation that don't have to do with you. It sucks. Like if you find a new job or whatever, everybody's going to go to UCSF or whatever it is, but it's not about you. It's harder, I think, when it's something that happens to you about you that you don't have much control over.
Yeah, I mean, just being able to change your perception and see the situation different is incredibly important. Like as far as like habits go, like is there stuff that you know in the back of your mind you would go to in order to, you know, maintain some sense of discipline and control over certain things? Like would you stay committed to exercising, surfing? I know you were into mixed martial arts. Like what does your, you know, routine look like if you, you know, fall into some sort of depression?
Yeah, all of those things, right? I think the big thing is if you get into a depressive episode, it's important to like recognize it quickly and to address it really rapidly, because actually we know that the longer that people stay in these episodes, the more locked in it is, right? And so, you know, personally, I would try to keep my routine really quickly. I'd get on a daily routine of what I was going to do about a new job, and then I would try to do, you know, one of these rapid acting. If I felt like I was in a full blown depressive episode, I'd try to do one of these rapid acting treatments very quickly, you know, to get out of it. Another good example, right, is this example of people who drop into postpartum depression right after the baby is born, right? And I think that's a great example of, you know, a scenario where you got to really address it really quickly, right? And kind of pop out of it. You've got a baby, the mother has the baby, sometimes they breastfeed, you know, there's a bunch of care that needs to happen there usually. And so there's a need to really kind of address it really quickly, and I think have a plan around it. And just even having a plan puts people in a sense of greater control.
I guess, and then getting into some of these rapid acting treatments, I think that especially people in the recovery community are very, I mean, it can be stigmatizing, I think, to talk about things like psychedelics and ketamine when it comes to improving mental health, recovering from trauma, depression, stuff like that. I think an interesting place to start, though, with all that, before we get into like why you think these treatments are effective, is I heard you talk about like the personal, like relative, like drug use risk, you know, for people. And I think people would find it interesting that I think something that people use very regularly is like one of the most dangerous substances for people. So to talk a bit about the relative risk for certain substances and how they all rank.
You know, I have probably a more unique view of these things. I think, you know, there haven't been, you know, really good exhaustive studies of cannabinoids for psychiatric illness. There have been some for CBD, but not for the THC component. So the part that we really think about, that hasn't really happened. For CBD, the cannabidiol that actually seems to be stripped out of a lot of kind of modern day marijuana, that hasn't really gotten under the radar at the level that seems to be pretty therapeutic for things like people have explored that as a kind of a adjunctive treatment for schizophrenia. You know, it's been explored for epilepsy and seems to work in certain genetic forms of epilepsy. And so there's that, but THC is kind of problematic. It has a psychosis risk to it, particularly like the synthetic cannabinoids that are THC like drugs. You know, the psychedelics are having a reemergence. You know, we have some data coming out on that. I think that's more of a clear kind of therapeutic signal. The issues there are just that people have what kind of get processed on as side effects that are really like part and parcel, like part of the psychedelic experience, right? And so if you have this experience, like you feel like you felt like you have this, like, I'm dying in the trip experience, then people see that as what they call an adverse event, you know, but that ends up being for some people part of the experience. And if you're feeling like that in trip and you're in a study, let's say for end-stage terminal cancer, for depression and anxiety, and you have an experience of death in the trip that prepares your mind for actual death, that may not necessarily be a side effect, right? People come out of that and they'll describe that as being like helpful for preparing their mind for their imminent death, right? They're going to die in a month from terminal cancer. Then that experience isn't necessarily processed by the person as bad, right? And so we have this weird, complicated regulatory process where we have to talk about things as being adverse events. And it's, I mean, actually, it's not weird. It's pretty normal, but like the interaction of that with psychedelics is kind of weird, right? Because then some of the things we think about as adverse events may or may not be, and we have to kind of wrap our mind around how to think about it. TMS is much easier. Like, there's a very rare risk of seizure. Nobody's had a seizure, knock on wood, with our approaches. I've seen it once ever in the history of doing this. It's really, really rare. People have headaches and that's it. You know, it makes it a lot more scalable because people don't have these problems of other psychological experiences, you know? And so that's going to be kind of the issue when we're thinking about what to push for or kind of first line therapeutics. It's probably going to end up being more likely to be neuromodulation. And then you bring people in for something like a psychedelic if neuromodulation doesn't work. There are conditions where, you know, neuromodulation is contraindicated, though, where seizure risk is a lot higher, like people with traumatic brain injury, people with alcohol use disorder are going to seize much more readily. So there is that. That's kind of the scenario. Is that helpful?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was just, I'm also interested in like, where does alcohol, like, you know, rank in all of this? Because I think it's becoming more, not obvious, but more known that alcohol, just because it's readily available and legal, isn't like the safest thing for everybody to use.
I pretty much quit drinking completely. I mean, I was never more than a social drinker anyways, where I'd drink, like, I'd go to Napa and drink, you know, go to a wine tasting or something like that. So it's not a big behavior change for me, but the data on drinking is so bad from a cancer risk that even that confers some cancer risk. Even that very rare once a month, once every 2 weeks, like, glass of wine confers an increase in your cancer risk, right? And so there's a whole crew of folks, particularly in Silicon Valley, but I think, you know, internationally, but there's, it feel, you can feel it here, where alcohol is not part of the equation. You know, what do they say? What happens in California spreads or whatever. My suspicion is that we're going to look at alcohol in the same way we looked at smoking in 20 years. These doctors, they're smoking, and these pictures that we see now, we think it's so crazy. We're going to have that same view of alcohol in 20 years. And the doc, these pictures of doctors drinking wine and stuff, I think that's going to go away. Because it's becoming like really, really clear that the cancer risk from this stuff is so high. It, not to mention like all the other risks of really heavy drinking, but even light drinking, you know, where we thought like one glass of wine a day was heart healthy. It's not, you know, that sort of thing. There's like a reversal that like no drinking is indicated. And so I think that alcohol is probably going to be out. I think that it's going to look a lot like smoking. I think that we're going to come to a place where THC heavy cannabis use is really going to be on the decline. Then it's really interesting. If you look at everything in context with everything else, then what do people then do? You know, like what ends up happening there? You know, if bars are going to take a hit, which they might, you know, what happens there? And I think it's TBD, quite honestly.
Why do psychedelics and stuff like that, like why do you see, think that they work, they can work so well for, you know, treatment resistant depression and for trauma and stuff like that? Like, is it because of what it does to the brain? Is it because of how your brain responds? So how does this all work?
And we're still trying to figure out the how, right? The how is hard because, you know, there hasn't been legality in being able to even do these studies for a long time. But, you know, the early signs is that there's some similarities to how TMS works, where you're having an effect on certain brain circuits, default mode network, the salience network, the cognitive control network in ways that promote control too, which is great. It's a similar frame. At the like psychological level, people have these insights that they couldn't have in a different kind of brain state. And they come out of it saying, oh, I'm actually thinking about that problem in a different way, which may be a big piece of it, right? And the cause and effect of, does the brain change as a result of the insight, or what, or does the brain change and then you have the insight or whatever? We have no idea about that. But it's this idea that for whatever reason, people have these experiences and then they have a new way of looking at the world. And that seems to be really consistent. And if you think about like kind of longer timescales, you know, we've been doing, you know, humans on at least, you know, some places on the planet have been exploring these substances for a lot longer than anything else has been around, way longer than TMS or oral antidepressants have been around. Humans have been doing that for thousands and thousands of years. There's probably a reason for that. It's probably not just an idiosyncratic cultural phenomenon, right? Maybe. You know, there are things that are idiosyncratic cultural phenomenon. Some parts of the world pierce, other people don't pierce. Some people have tattoos, others don't. Doesn't really change your health. But I don't think, given how widespread psychedelic use was in desperate, unconnected parts of the world, that it's an idiosyncratic cultural phenomenon. I think there is some, probably a mental health group effects that were observed and that were retained in the culture.
I think people, they get scared because when they think of things like psychedelics, their mind goes into, at times, like acid and like, you know, hard strains of like mushrooms and stuff like that. And they think that, okay, like, does this mean that people are recommending that people just go on these intense trips, like in the wilderness, or just, you know, just sitting around listening to music in order to like beat depression? But it's much more clinical than that, right?
Oh, it's much more clinical. I mean, do people go out and elect to go have like a battlefield like surgery in the middle of the woods when you could get your surgery in the operating room? Nobody ever elects to do that. So why would you? I mean, I totally hear what you're saying, and your question is super valid. But my response is, it's an enculturation phenomenon. We're like enculturated in all these ways that we don't even realize it, right? Like we're constantly being culturated into thinking things. And then we think the world works, has to work in that way. Actually, like, it's all highly medicalized, and it has to be, right? And anybody going and doing like a sweat lodge and taking peyote, or, you know, you shouldn't even really be doing that because the peyote stores are not very high for the Native Americans. But somebody taking that sort of a road is actually an anomaly in this context. And really, we should be thinking about, how do we modernize and medicalize these processes to de-risk them, to understand them, to create a scenario for people where they have a consistent outcome? Even just going and getting a plant-based psychedelic, you don't know what the dosages are. I mean, this is just like, and you could be taking it in a medical setting, but you know, if you go and get mushrooms from place one to place two to place three that have psilocybin-containing mushrooms, they may have very different concentrations, right? It all has to be medicalized, and it all has to be within the frame of standard medicine, just like your surgery does, just like your root canal does. It all needs to happen in medical settings, and then that's going to reduce the ambiguity.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree in that for this all to kind of work, it has to be like standardized in a medical setting. And I think also that'll help like destigmatize a lot of it and people's fears around all of the solutions that things like you're talking about could offer. And so, Nolan, I could talk to you for hours about this stuff because I'm super fascinated by your work. but I want to be respectful of your time. So if people like are intrigued, they want to learn more about your lab and keep up with the research that you're doing, where's the best place to do that?
So bsl.stanford.edu.
Amazing. Well, I will make sure to include the link to that in the show notes. And thanks again for your time and for coming on. I really appreciate it.